Welcome to the Evolving Advisor Podcast, dedicated to equipping independent financial advisors with the tips, insights, and knowledge to help you achieve success in business and life. Host Jeff Concepcion shares 30 years of experience as an advisor, entrepreneur, and CEO. Join Jeff and the industry's top thought leaders as they help you evolve from where you are today to where you want to be tomorrow. Now here's your host, Jeff Concepcion.
Hi, this is Jeff Concepcion, and welcome to the Evolving Advisor Podcast. I'm very pleased today to have a good friend and partner and collaborator, Jeff Nash, the CEO and co-founder of Bridgemarq Strategies. With 25 plus years of industry experience, he spent time as a financial advisor early in his career, as a senior executive of business development at LPL for 14 years, and has been running Bridgemarq now, where we've had the pleasure of collaborating once again after his time at LPL. Jeff earned a bachelor's degree from Colby College in Waterville, Maine. He then earned his MBA from Bentley University in Waltham, Massachusetts, and he lives in Charlotte, North Carolina with his wife and three children. In his spare time, he's a golfer, a tennis player, and he also enjoys fishing. So thanks for joining us today, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I know Colby, you have to tell me where Waterville, Maine is.
So Waterville is about 20, 30 miles north of Augusta, the capital, more inland. So it doesn't skirt the coast. And it's part of a whole network of colleges that is considered to be the New England Small College Athletic Conference is the conference it's in. So it competes with colleges like Tufts University, Williams College, Amherst College. You know, then of course, there's the big three in Maine, which are Colby, Bates, and Bowdoin are the big.
Yes. So I think that was in our division. I went to Trinity in Hartford, Connecticut. I think Colby was one of the schools, at least at the time, in the network.
So, yeah, definitely. We definitely played you guys.
And I was asking about Maine because I just spent a couple of days at Acadia National Park in Barn Harbor, Maine with my son last week hiking. It was absolutely stunning and incredible.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's a pretty state.
You probably hit it with about a month to go before you get locked out there where it's just going to be too cold to come and go. I'm kidding, a little bit sarcastic, but
it's, No. It was chilly and we absolutely caught the tail end of the season. There was still enough foliage and color that it was gorgeous. It was cold, but tolerable. And, you know, so it was actually really, really nice. So a beautiful state. So walk us through, Jeff, just a little bit. I know I kind of highlighted the financial advisor and your years at LPL, but walk us through a little bit of the career path and how you kind of floated throughout the financial services and wealth management industry for most, if not all, of your career.
Sure, absolutely. Appreciate that. Yeah, I started off in 1993 as a financial advisor. Before that, I was actually in the banking world, working in the retail banking universe. And back then in Massachusetts, the Glass-Steagall had been repealed and the banks rolled out their investment program. So I was became a financial advisor, one of the first financial advisors in a bank channel back then. And I did that for about 6.5 years, kind of growing and developing a good little book of business at the time. But had always had a flair for kind of the fee-based side of the business. And it really hit a crossroads at the bank in the late 90s and 99 when I was looking to kind of evolve out of the bank. And candidly, at the time of my career, I wasn't sure what direction I wanted to go into, whether I wanted to actually stay as a financial advisor or look more on the corporate side of the world. So I did some kind of scouring the marketplace and said, okay, here's what I'm looking at doing. And I actually, all of us just kind of randomly, I got a phone call from an industry headhunter who introduced me to LPL in a recruiting position for LPL. What was interesting is at the time, this is again back in 99, I had always known of LPL. In fact, I had friends that were independent advisors with LPL. And literally that was one of the things I was even considering myself was to just leave the bank and become an independent advisor with LPL. Well, as it turned out, I met some of the leadership, including the CEO of LPL. And as they say, the rest is history. You know, I really became, you know, passionate with the story of LPL and helping advisors learn the independent side of the world and spent, you know, a great 14 years at LPL where I had a lot of different opportunities, a lot of different roles inside of the firm, you know, from starting off as a recruiter to ending running much of the recruiting team. And in the middle, I actually launched a business consulting and succession planning team for LPL that focused on coaching, consulting advisors, and helping them better understand the marketplace around succession planning and even putting deals together.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So that really explains quite a bit. I think number one, sort of your penchant for business development, but also the fact that I think you take an an unusually participatory role in the process. It's not just sort of making introductions and connections. It's really understanding the practices, understanding their needs, and really that consulting approach. And maybe that's to some extent as a result of the fact that there was a segue between your business development and the fact that you were very engaged in developing a coaching and consulting, you know, practice or business for LPL.
Yeah, it's definitely always been that side for me, right? So when I left LPL, which was the end of 2012, and I started this business here with Bridgemark Strategies, you know, one of my latter roles at LPL was actually overseeing LPL's relationship with the third-party recruiters that were out there in the marketplace. And by seeing some of those third-party recruiters, I really understood that recruiting model in the industry was a transactional-based model. It was introduce a prospective advisor to a firm and collect a commission for making that introduction. Really not that dissimilar how a lot of financial advisors, I'll call brokers, started in the business 30 years ago, where you were just selling, you know, a municipal bond or 100 shares of IBM. It was completely transactional. And my opportunities at LPL, where I was in senior leadership, and at the time, it was kind of a smaller company, you really get to understand how broker dealers work. The old expression is how the sausage is made. And it really allowed me with that consulting approach of always working with advisors from a consultative perspective to then start this firm with a real consultative approach for advisors that didn't really exist in the marketplace. You know, I felt like there were very few firms in the marketplace that actually tried to help advisors evaluate the choices in the marketplace and kind of stay connected with them throughout their decision-making process to really just become a smarter advocate as well as kind of a coach to these advisors with all of the different decisions that they have to make.
Yeah, and you bring up a great point, right? So I think what you find probably is in the best, not all, and probably not the majority, but in sort of the top quartile, the best business development firms, it's really more than sourcing and introductions. It's understanding the advisor's needs. It's understanding the choice that's available in the marketplace and understanding maybe where they might fit, what they value, because there are so many choices. You know, I talk to advisors every day and they're sort of overwhelmed with all the noise of all the deals and the resources and the support. And it's very, very hard for someone who's particularly coming from an employee model to decipher that and figure out how do I really find a good home?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. It's not only more complicated than it's ever been, right? What's interesting, if we could look at, we actually can look at some statistics in the industry, and there's actually 25% fewer broker dealers than there were 10 or 15 years ago than there are today. But I think absolutely the choices for advisors is significantly more complicated. Certainly we have the upstart of the RIA space, and it's not even an upstart anymore. It's a robust, thriving, you know, decision point for advisors. Then we also have within the RIA space, we have aggregators and integrators, strategic acquirers and platform providers, right? And this all competes with the broker dealer side of the universe. And it's not even independents versus employee anymore, where there's so much overlap where traditional firms are starting independent sides of the business and traditional independent firms are starting W-2 sides of the business. So it really does become complicated from an advisor's perspective to really have somebody help them understand their own business and their business goals, and then to understand the marketplace and really help them save time and money by narrowing down the field of choice.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So as advisors look to choose, and obviously you've had 1,000 conversations over the course of your career, can you pinpoint a couple, 2 or 3 items that were particularly for advisors leaving an employee model, be it a bank or a wire or any type of employee model, what do you tend to see as 2 or 3 key drivers, the things that motivate them most? When you think about culture, when you think about compensation, when you think about control, or are there 2 or 3 areas that not all, but many advisors consistently look for when they look towards independence?
You know, it's an easy thing, actually. It really is. I've actually studied this. I've surveyed it in my career, surveying advisors, and it's by far, and it's so interesting because it's really individual to the person, but it all fits into one big definition. By far, the number one reason why W-2 advisors leave their firm is quality of life. It really is. And that can be they don't like their branch manager. They don't like the culture of the firm. They don't like the firm is on the front page of the newspaper, right? You know, or in the news lines all the time. They don't like the payout. They don't like whatever element it is. It really is about quality of life. And so when I've studied these advisors, we look at independence, we look at payout, We look at all the draws of different firms and why people switch firms. It's amazing that it all comes back to an individual decision of how someone defines quality of life, which can be uniquely defined by the individual, but that overwhelmingly becomes the reason why people leave those W-2 environments.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Because as you were saying that, one thing crossed my mind, quality of life, which is very broad, right? So I think probably the top quartile, the best business development firms, help advisors define what it means for them, because I'm not sure that they entirely know when they're looking. They have a sense, but maybe guiding them, and that's part of that whole consultative nature, is helping them define quality of life. What does that mean for you in your career now and in what you seek?
No question, there's a road mapping, right? A lot of what we do is that road mapping process. Hey, what do you want to get to? And then how do we get you from point A to point B? It's not so easy, right? A lot of folks look at the RIA space as an example, right? There's still questions even within the RIA space. Should they even be their own RIA or not? Some people are very passionate around yes, and some people are rather very passionate around no. And interestingly, it's not always connected to the assets that the person manages. It's just some of their beliefs. But it's also, how do they get there from point A to point B? And that's a big journey to really understand capabilities, strengths, and weaknesses, right? Being honest with what people's gaps are. And they really confide in us for us to be able to help them, and them kind of educating us on what they think of their own strengths. And we kind of have those really candid conversations. You know, we really act as a coach and consultant in helping them make that decision to, again, find that roadmap to find their right journey.
Yeah, so I think there's a connection here. So when I put my advisor hat on, I've been an advisor my whole career, and I am to a lesser extent today, but I still have a practice, even though I maybe dabble an hour or two a week because of time constraints. But I think the great advisors are advisors who tell clients what they need to hear and not what they want to hear. So if there are issues with their budgets or their spending or meeting their goals, you know, it's not that the advisors say everything's going to work out great. It's to say, look, you're not going to achieve your goals if you do X, Y, and Z. And it might be similar in the business development side to tell an advisor, you want to run your own firm? Honestly, I would be fearful of you doing that. And here are the reasons why. This is why supported independence might make sense. Whereas you might be encouraging others to say, yeah, you have all the skill sets. Now the question is it the best utilization of your time? But having candid dialogue, telling them some things that may be evident and other things that maybe they're not really acknowledging about challenges that they might face, as well as some of the opportunities they might benefit from going independent.
No question. I mean, that supported independence, it is, there are so many firms that are, I would say, trying to, right? Clearly, a lot of firms have already built some support for that. And there's a lot of firms trying to get deeper into that supported independence, right? And I think more and more advisors are also looking at that supported independence. They just love being an advisor, right? And when you're an advisor and you look at what it takes to be an advisor, and then when you get to a certain point, right? And that certain point is different for different people, but you go from being an advisor to running a company. And the more you become running a company, the less you become running an advisor. And you really have to assess what is it you enjoy more, right? And it's not always about net take home. It's really about what you enjoy the most. And one of the things that we talk to people a lot about is, again, not just their payout. We talk about enterprise value. Enterprise value is a concept that I think is getting to be broader understood, but definitely not widely understood across the street, of how people can really affect the value of their company, which has significant more opportunity and upside than what they could look at from just a pure cash flow perspective.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It sounds like we went to the same school as far as our thoughts on the industry, because advisors tend to think about compensation. They think less about balance sheet, right? The fact that when they own their, and a lot of folks who are independent already are still thinking that way, as opposed to thinking that I'm building this asset, this enduring value that's going to have so much of an impact on my family, on my wealth, on my retirement. But they think as an advisor, not as a CEO. And as you mentioned, I think you're spot on. It's kind of evolving to think about running a business. And do they want to? Some advisors love the client contact. They love managing assets. They love, you know, all these things. And some of them are really good at that. But you can't be all things to all people. So it's kind of determining what's my path, where am I going to spend my time, and what's the outcome? What kind of business will I have as a result of that focus?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it really is. The CEO role is something that, as a small business, they have to take on those multiple roles, but then they have to really assess which is it that they enjoy the most. Do they enjoy being a CEO? And there's nothing wrong with either of those directions, right? It's a matter of putting the people in place as you continue to grow that support your strengths and your weaknesses and your likes and your dislikes, right? Oh, that's something that we all do.
that all makes sense. Talk about trends, Jeff. Over the last couple of years, have there been any significant trends that you've seen? The obvious one is, you know, folks leaving wired employee models to go independent. The RIAs have obviously gained a lot of traction. But what other trends, if any, do you see, not only in the way of migration, but maybe even just in the form of best practices of what successful, where they're going and what successful advisors are actually doing?
Yeah, a couple things, right? So one of the things that I think, and it's not yet a trend, but it's something to be aware of, is there is definitely going to be a greater and greater push towards this, not just the W-2 advisor scenario, it's the salaried advisor. That salaried advisor, it's actually starting, which people don't necessarily realize, it's starting in the RIA channel, but it's going to be widely adopted in the wirehouse channel. And that's something that people need to be aware that it's happening and it's going to continue to happen. I would say 20 years ago, most financial advisors would be defined as hunter killers, right? They're out there finding new business. And today, the next generation of financial advisors are largely better at relationship managers. And the compensation differential can be very great, very significant between those two roles. And firms are hiring the relationship manager, financial advisor, who's a really good planner, really good client person, and even good at bringing in new assets off of a book of business. But they're compensating them on a salary with a bonus structure. And I think that's one of the things to be really aware of. On the flip side of that, firms themselves, what I see as a trend is there is so much money in this industry coming into this industry, looking to get into this industry. It is a very fractured industry by definition, as multiple broker dealers, multiple RIA firms. We've got large wirehouse teams that could be a couple billion dollars that are then starting their own RIA. And there is an enormous amount of both private equity money and family office money. And the family office money is another whole conversation that's interesting out there in the marketplace as to how that's changing the landscape of even the private equity investments. But there's all of this institutional money that's looking to get into this fractured marketplace, acquire, aggregate, grow, and scale, and then potentially flip on what would be significant profit returns. And so those are a couple of trend lines that I'm seeing that aren't as broadly talked about, where the insatiable appetite of the private equity and family office money buying businesses is driving price. And so it really is important for individuals or firms that might be interested in taking advantage of this. There's clearly some structural things they need to be focused on to take advantage of it, right? It's not just about buying any practice. It's about buying the right practices that look right. Because I see these practices, some of them going at ridiculous multiples, and others going at discounts. And it really is about how they're structured to be able to take advantage of this.
Yeah, those are a couple of great observations. So just one quick comment on the advisor component. And then I want to talk a little bit about private equity and family offices, the M&A space. So I couldn't agree with you more that particularly in the wirehouses, but even in a lot of the RIAs, I think the wires are every day making those books of business less the FA's book and more sort of the property of the house, if you will. 100%. They're paying the advisors less. They're pushing more money to deferred. They're trying to create more uniformity and consistency and outcomes. And I think it's just sort of this little tiny slice that each year the FAs are less and less in control. They're being paid less and less to manage larger books. And I think it's a migration towards what would ultimately potentially become, you know, an employee model and a salary-based employee model. So I couldn't agree with you more there. I liked your notion about M&A and what's taking place. I do think that prices are moving up, and I do think that there are, again, a combination of aggregators, family offices, and PE firms that are driving those multiples up. And not only are the multiples, you know, beginning to increase, and they have for a while in the large space, but I think you're even seeing it trickle down into mid-sized businesses, not so much the small businesses yet. But I'd love to see, you know, what your thoughts are on the trends of how aggregators, family offices, and PE are affecting succession planning and transitions.
So let me speak to that. Let me go back to the first thing on the salary side of the wirehouses, right? It's not just you and I talking about this. If you listen to what's happening in the marketplace, it's actually taking hold, and they're actually putting the pieces in place. So folks should be aware of that. Like, so for example, Merrill Lynch with Merrill Edge, right? It's a W-2 salary environment for them. they keep talking about the success that they're having in Merrill Edge on new account opening, on asset growth, right? That's a huge driver of their profitability. And when they start talking about that, when they bring in a new head of training, which they did a couple of months ago, that's focused on Merrill Edge, this is stuff that really is setting the table for them to continue to drive more greater. It'll be, so Merrill Edge will go up to, at some point, it'll be probably $500,000 or even $1 million minimums of the accounts that will end up going to Merrill Edge, right? I think it's at 250 today. And everyone said at the time when it was when they first started it, that it was $100,000. And then it went up from 100 to 250, right? So they're really setting this up to continue to push that side of it because it's significantly more profitable. So I agree with what you were saying as well. And people really should understand that this is happening. As it relates to the private equity piece that you were asking, I think no question, right? I see businesses today that are really well positioned and firms would love to get into that, right? And then I see businesses today that are just practices. And it's not always about the assets, by the way, it's about how these businesses are run, right? So when you are running a practice, then you'll tend to have more individually managed portfolios versus model portfolios. You'll have a lot of key man issues, which means that they may, even if there's one advisor, the clients only know that advisor, right? Not even so much the client service team. It's all about the advisor. And you get a little bit of what we would even call superhero syndrome, where everything is directed back to the advisor, you know? And so a business starts to then separate out where you have a whole team of people and clients are just accustomed to working with the team. You have model portfolios that clients, and these become more easily transferable. And so when we look at when we look at financial advisors that are running more businesses, this is incredibly attractive for these private equity firms. And we see market multiples, you know, in the couple hundred million dollar range in the 5 to 6 times profit, which we would define as EBITDA. And we see them in the $1 billion range of going up to 8 and 9 times profit or EBITDA. But we see deals that can exceed those numbers in any of those ranges based on the attractiveness of the individual practice. So I think that gets to what your question is what are we seeing in this on the pricing and deal flow? And it really is, you know, for advisors and firms that have organized and structured themselves, it's incredibly attractive because these firms are able to generate immediate synergies and then use that those synergies as also as a driver of growth. And that becomes very profitable for both the acquired and the acquiring.
Yeah, and it's interesting, right? So acquiring a book of business is one thing and then integrating it is another. Mm-hmm. And I think you also see some stark differences and contrasts in firms that are out there sort of gathering up assets and buying firms, but not really creating a lot of consistency. And I think those firms will probably struggle more over time versus others. And again, it's interesting too, because if you're acquiring a firm or even an interest in a firm and allowing them to be themselves, particularly if you're willing to take a minority stake out of the box, you start to, I think, run into less competition. There aren't a lot of folks out there that say, hey, you're running Bridgemarq Wealth Management, continue to run it the way you want, use your brand. We're going to help you have a little bit of monetization. We're going to coach and consult. And this is kind of where we've been looking to carve out some space for ourselves. You know, be yourself, and our goal is to help you be a better version of you. And that flexibility and autonomy, there's less of that there. That being said, over time, the more of those firms that you sort of collect in a basket that are still being themselves, the harder it is to manage. So I think at some point, being thoughtful about integration and economies of scale and consistency is also an important equation for firms today that are kind of putting stuff in the basket, if you will.
Oh, I agree. And I think first of all, I agree, there's not as many folks doing that. I think with a longer term focus on that and using a carrot approach to it, I think it actually will work really well for both the acquired and the acquiring, right? So that carrot approach, it becomes, you know, over time, they become synergies, right, that you leverage. There becomes efficiencies, there becomes scale. You know, so if I'm the individual acquired and I give up 20 or 30 or 40% of my business, but I still have majority, and I realize my strategic partner can actually just run portfolio management better than me, right, and become more efficient. Because again, if I'm managing that business, I'm largely doing it myself with maybe a part-timer who's also helping me. So there's that carrot approach where it says, oh, let's just outsource this to my strategic partner. And I think that's where you can generate some real scale and opportunity as well in that space.
Yeah. So knowing what you know about the industry, I'm curious for you just to kind of continue that thought a little bit. What are a handful of the things, and I'll throw a couple items out there, that you think most advisors would value in the way of support, whether it's asset management, clearly, you know, supervision, and risk management, compliance, real estate? What are some of, what would be sort of the top, you know, Letterman's top list of things that advisors recognize, this is really something I'm probably better off outsourcing, either because someone can do it better, more effectively, more cost efficiently, or because I'm just not really good at it? What does that list look like?
So I think the three things are, you know, certainly portfolio management, space, and HR, right? I mean, I think those are the three things. But what's interesting about those three things, and they really do add value for advisors, is advisors don't necessarily assign value to it during a recruiting process, right? So they look at those three things as, boy, I'm paying a lot, and don't recognize how much time they can spend on those three things. You know, to me, one of the most significant things that attracts a ton of advisors, and not a lot of firms are able to do this, but it's absolutely out there, is advisors, no matter how successful they've been, are always still fearful about how the next account is going to come into their firm. The vast majority of advisors, to me, are not growing their business. By industry statistics, they technically are growing their business. As we describe growing your business, to me, growing your business is actually having a growth plan, marketing, whether it's seminars, you know, which are, of course, hard to do during COVID, but some type of a growth strategy to actually grow new business. It's not just generating a couple of referrals a year from existing clients and having the market appreciate a few percentage points and growing your business that way. That, to me, is a maturing business, not a growing business. And so from an appeal perspective, advisors are definitely interested in people that can help them grow. From an efficiencies perspective, absolutely, especially coming from a W-2 environment, that structured independence. But I see a lot of it with HR. I mean, I talk to a lot of firms that you would, that the industry would define as successful firms, right? And these are folks with teams of 10 or more people, and they look at the future of themselves as they want to double or triple their business, and they recognize that they then have to go to 20 or 30 people to support that. And when you have 20 or 30 people to support that growth, you're not a practice anymore. You're a firm with a full-time HR person.
Right.
And that's some of the stuff that advisors are, they really need that support in being able to outsource that.
Yeah, it's a great point. And HR is just, it's an interesting example, right? It's funny how far we got in our growth trajectory without even having internal HR for our firm. And then when we brought it in, and for some of our better advisors, we started to give them just a little taste or exposure when we had some bandwidth, how much they valued what they defined as HR, which is, in their case, was really more the acquisition, not only the acquisition, but the retention of talent. So how do I find great people? How do I create a career path? How do I reward them? Do I consider equity or phantom equity at some point? But it's just really finding and keeping good people. And most of our partners say, hey, we're not really good at this. You know, we're advisors. So it's interesting as they would sort of identify pain points or areas that they felt could help them be better operators. That's how many of our services evolved in HR, which you pointed out is one of those.
So. You know, it's so interesting when we think about this industry, and there's a ton of statistics on this. The average financial advisor in a wirehouse is managing more assets than the independent advisor and is also spending more time with clients than the average independent advisor, right? The average independent advisor spends less time with clients because they have to run the business. There's things, aspects to running the business that take them away. Now, the average independent advisor net income as a percentage is certainly significantly higher than the average wirehouse advisor. But as we look at the challenges of the marketplace on the independent side, right, it is really getting folks to understand growth is a function of time, and time is a function of distraction. And this is why some of the things that the wirehouses have learned over the years is keeping things simple allows advisors to focus on, right, on clients. Now, of course, the wirehouses, as we all know, one thing that's different is they don't give up ownership to the clients even, right? Half of the wirehouses, two of the major four wirehouses, they're not even a part of the protocol to let you take those clients. And there's been, you know, swirling rumors for years that at least one of them may leave that, you know, so we just never know. The wirehouses absolutely, you know, can drop out of the protocol at any point. And then where does that leave those advisors? They're back to non-solicit agreements and, you know, having to struggle a little bit more so. You know, so it's not the formula clearly in the wirehouse, but it is absolutely when we think about the time spent, there's something to be said on keeping things simple to allow folks to manage more assets and grow their business.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And I guess while you mentioned the topic, what are you seeing the last couple of years now with the two of the big four who withdrew from the protocol? Are those advisors moving as successfully or almost as successfully? And how would you rate sort of the level of complexity for, I guess, Morgan Stanley and UBS advisors leaving versus Merrill and Wells who've remained in the protocol?
Yeah, they really are. I mean, there was absolutely a slowdown initially when they left the protocol, both of those firms, and now they're moving really freely, you know? And so, I mean, there's definitely different I's dotting and T's crossing that those advisors need to be addressing, and they should probably have some legal representation to walk them through specifics and so that they're comfortable. But they are absolutely moving. It's not restricting the ability to move. It was kind of before the protocol ever existed, those advisors were moving as well.
Right.
Back to. So we see very large teams. We even see, you know, mid-sized teams, you know, all breaking away from those teams and either going independent or joining other firms.
Yeah, lots of pearls of wisdom. So I really, really appreciate the comments and the insights. A tremendous alignment. I agree with the lion's share of what you put out there. I guess my final question would be, any words of advice for advisors who have plateaued? And by the way, when I say plateau, it could be someone at a half billion who aspires to get to a billion. It could be someone at 50 million who wants to get to $100 million. What do you see the best practitioners doing? And what advice would you give as a coach and as a consultant as to how I sort of break through where I'm at and strive to get to the next level? And whether it's talent, whether it's focus, whether it's technology or efficiency, what are some of the things I should be thinking about to try to go to the next level as an advisor?
You know, it's a great question. And I'd say just honestly, off the top of my head, the easiest answer to that is just actually come to realize it, right? I think so often people who have plateaued don't necessarily recognize that they've plateaued. For those folks who have plateaued and recognize that they've plateaued, then it would be more natural to seek help, right? And seeking help, whether it's hiring a consultant or a coach like myself, you know, switching firms, you know, taking on a partner, there's a lot of different ways to get that help. But it really is, it starts with a self-awareness of, hey, I've kind of plateaued, I need some help. And then it's really from that self-awareness, it's to determine where are the areas that you need the most help. And from there to try to figure out what's the right structure of the company and what is the next iteration and build that plan. Right. I look at things in 1, 3, 5 and sometimes 10-year plans. I say sometimes 10. We always look at a 10-year plan, but we recognize that it's good to have a plan 10 years out, but it's hard to predict 10 years out. And so when we look at 1, 3, 5 and 10, it really is, okay, what are we going to do? What's our goal? What do we want to look like in 5 years? And how do we get there over the next 1 and 3? And it really is, you know, for those advisors, and there's so many of them, that goes back to what I describe in the maturing of the business. There are so many advisors that I feel that have plateaued and they're making great income. It's a great lifestyle practice. But I really have concerns for a lot of advisors in our industry, especially as the average age continues to mature, of these practices getting to a point where they become declining assets. And as I was saying, record deals earlier on this podcast, and I absolutely believe they're out there. It's for those advisors who've organized and structured right. And for those advisors who have plateaued or worse, if they're declining, it really is, it's you know, something that you got to really self-assess to really figure out what's the right organizational structure to kind of continue to go forward.
Yeah, great insights, Jeff. Thanks so much. And I've thoroughly enjoyed myself hearing the thoughts and the wisdom. Clearly, you know the space extraordinarily well and really articulated some great themes. So I appreciate that. At this point, we're going to segue to the way we close every episode. With podcast karaoke, can you share with us what you're going to be singing today? And I know that you did mention that you're hoping to phone a friend.
And I brought my daughter here to sing a little karaoke. I'm a big Red Sox fan, and we used to sing this at every game at the Red Sox. I haven't been to a game in a while. And of course, with COVID, no one's going to games anymore. But I hope everyone will enjoy this.
Where began? I can't begin to know when, but then I know it's growing strong. Was in the spring, and spring became the summer, who had believed you come along. Hands, touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you. Sweet Caroline, good times never seem so good.
Thanks for listening to The Evolving Advisor. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. And if you would like to talk about succession planning or practice acquisitions, please drop us a line. We would love to help you in any way we can.